Welcome to the Tennis Worthy Podcast, brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I'm Chris Bowers, and in January 2023, the Hall of Fame launched a podcast featuring long-form audio interviews with a selection of tennis legends. There were 12 of them in 2023 and another 12 in 2024, all of them still available for you to listen to at tennisfame.com/podcast or to download from your preferred podcast platform. Three of the interviews in the second series featured five history makers from that pivotal time in the history of tennis, the sport going open in 1968, effectively the professionals and amateurs coming together in the same competitions. And the five voices you're going to hear now were all involved in that dramatic period between 1968 and 73, when tennis took the steps that enabled it to become the global professional discipline and spectacle it is today. First up is Ken Rosewall, who was a youthful 88 years old when he spoke to me in Melbourne about the reality he faced as an amateur in the mid-1950s when he decided to abandon tennis's traditional tournaments and turn professional.
My father and mother were hard-working parents and we didn't have much financial backing. I was employed by Sazners, but, you know, it wasn't a lot of money. And then I had a job basically because of Mr. Blacklock, who was the managing director of Sazners and a friend of people who ran the Carnation Milk Company. So I had a small influence and small job with them for that year. So that kind of kept us going. But, you know, my intention was to turn pro if I was good enough and could get an offer from Mr. Cramer.
Well, you clearly were good enough and you got an offer from Jack Cramer. Was it very sad to have to leave the prestigious tournaments, or was it a no-brainer given the economics of your life?
Yeah, I think it was more or less a no-brainer, plus the fact that, I'd just been married in October, so my wife and I were, fortunately she enjoyed tennis. She probably got sick of watching me play, but she did travel a lot with me in the early years, that first year when I was a professional, but I didn't think I'd have much choice about turning professional because Mr. Cramer was keen for me to come in with a group, and I didn't really recognise what I was in for, playing 80 matches or so against Pancho Gonzalez. It was quite some terrorising moments for me, playing him on his favourite surface, indoors and on canvas. That was pretty fast kind of game, which was right up his alley. He was one of the top players.
Was there a resentment among the pro players that you were clearly a level above the amateurs, but they were getting all the attention because they were playing all the traditional tournaments like Wimbledon and the US and Australian Championships?
It wasn't anything that worried us too much, I don't think. We always had a hopeful intention that there would be some move towards open tennis and letting the pros play again, which nearly came in 1960, for various reasons it didn't.
It was a very close vote, yeah, so it could have come in when you were, 26?
Yeah, so it would have made a big difference to all of us, yeah. But, you know, for all of us fellows that came into the professional ranks, and some of the guys that did come in were doing okay from an amateur point of view in the so-called under-the-table payments, and it really happened because of the All England Club at Wimbledon. And Herman David, who was the then chairman, decided that they wanted to have an open event at the All England Club. So I think they got support from the English Tennis Association and the French and finally America and Australia. Yeah, we were happy when it came in, but we thought that our game was strong. So everybody was in it for the best players to make the most money.
And you were the champion in the first Open tournament in Bournemouth in April 1968 and the first Open major at Roland Garros 2 months later. What was the atmosphere like, and what does it mean to you to have been the champion of those two tournaments?
Well, it was very encouraging for our group. I mean, the professional circuit was mixed up together with different groups, but certainly playing at Bournemouth was an incentive for all of us to do quite well, and there was a few surprises there because it was very slippery clay courts, which once again I enjoyed playing on, so having won the tournament, you know, which didn't have that much money, I don't suppose. and then a month or so later to play in the French, you know, was really encouraging to be able to go back there and play as well as I did.
Ken Rosewall, and you wonder how many more major titles he'd have won if open tennis had come in earlier. It's impossible to tell, of course, as all his professional competitors would have been allowed to compete too. While 1968 is heralded as the big date in tennis history, the players turning professional was not accompanied by the sport's administration going professional. And in many ways, the traditional structure of tennis being run largely by volunteers working as part of national tennis associations continued after 1968. That was always going to cause a clash at some stage, and 5 years later, matters came to a head at the 1973 Wimbledon Championships. Then, more than 80 male players said they were not playing out of protest at a fellow professional being denied entry. A year earlier, the male players had formed themselves into a union, the Association of Tennis Professionals, or ATP. And their first president was the South African Cliff Drysdale, who was the reigning US Open doubles champion and had been singles runner-up at Forest Hills in 1965. The Wimbledon boycott meant Drysdale unwittingly became a centre of media attention and, to many tennis fans, the villain of the piece.
Like almost everything else in my life, this is something that I just slid into. It was not something that I was looking to do. I was a locker room politician with the other players. This is too long a story for us to go into in this format. But the bottom line is that the players began to realize that we were going to go back under the yoke of people other than ourselves. The International Tennis Federation was looking to expand or to recapture what they had lost through the turn toward professional tennis, and to determine what players could and couldn't do, and the professionals weren't going to do it. So we had discussions in the locker room about it. There was unanimous agreement between players who were still amateurs and those who were contract pros. Again, this is too complicated a conversation. And then there were pros who had signed contracts for professional living. And we all agreed on one thing, and that is that we did not want to go back to the days of when the International Tennis Federation controlled every move you made. So that's why it happened. And I happened to be there at the time and was interested in it and spoke to the players about it, got no opposition. There wasn't anybody who didn't see that what the track that we were about to take was the wrong track. Everybody knew we didn't want to go back.
And then within a year of the Association of Tennis Professionals being founded, you had a major battleground where Nicky Pilic was denied the chance to play a couple of Grand Slam tournaments because he hadn't played Davis Cup. And you were absolutely centre of attention, not just of the tennis world, but the whole media world, because there was a question of almost 100 players boycotting Wimbledon.
Yeah, it wasn't two Grand Slams. It was just Wimbledon. The French allowed him to play. Again, this is too long a story for this format, but the Yugoslav Federation banned Nicky Pilic from playing in any sanctioned tournaments because he wouldn't agree to play Davis Cup for him. But he was a professional, so that wasn't on the cards for us, and everybody in the locker room agreed with the principle that we were not going to go back to those days when the ITF would control the players. And Wimbledon backed the ITF, so it was a pretty... The French did not, the Italians did not, and just weeks later, Wimbledon did. You know, the ATP, we went in to try to have the law courts force Wimbledon to allow Nicky Pilic to play, which we were not successfully doing. And so the telephone call with Mike Gibson, the Monday morning of Wimbledon, 83 names, I think I read to him. These gentlemen are pulling out of the gentlemen's singles.
And how did you feel, as somebody whose life had been predominantly tennis, about leading a boycott, as much as you did lead it, of the most prestigious tournament?
Very disappointing for you to have to listen to what I'm saying, because these were things that just happened. It's not like I thought that I was on the brink of something historic. This was something that was necessary to do at the time, and we were going to do it regardless. I did not see myself as a historical figure in the birth of professional tennis, or at least the containment of what we had built up already and wanted to maintain. It was not like a born again moment for me. It just happened. We did it. I was proud of it. I didn't for one second look back and say, "Gee, we should have done something differently," because I don't think we should.
You had discussions with the British sports minister, who was a former Newsweek columnist, I think. You had discussions with lawyers. Did you occasionally have moments of thinking, this is surreal, I'm playing tennis and here we are? However much I get what you're saying about the, you know, this needed to happen, but it's a strange environment for a tennis player to be thrust into.
No. You're trying to goad me into making statements that will make it sound better to you. Yeah, this guy really realizes he was on the cusp of something. That's not what happened. We were just trying our damnedest to get Wimbledon to allow Nicky Pilic to play and not to bow to the Yugoslav Federation's request. And they refused to do that. And it wasn't more than 10 days after this whole process happened that everything changed and that they realized that they needed to include the players in the decision-making process of professional sports, and they did. So there was never anything that even came close to that again, ever.
One of the things that I picked up researching that era was that your whole approach was far more in sorrow than in anger. There was actually very little militancy about it.
No, again, it was just so natural and so normal. I wasn't upset with it. I think more disbelief that the authorities wouldn't see it our way and not realize that they were making a mistake going forward.
And when you look back on it now, do you just see it as something that, well, just a growing pain that professional tennis had to go through?
Yeah, but it was. That is exactly what it was. It would have happened anyway. It would have taken a little longer. But professional tennis was definitely on the way. Professional golf had been a huge success. Professional sports, period, basketball, football in the U.S. were huge successes, soccer, football in this country. So there was no doubt in my mind that we were headed in that direction. We still continue, even at this stage, to have, you know, wonder about exactly where it's headed, because there are always going to be little bumps in the road. Now we're talking about the Saudis injecting money into tennis, or what do you do about that? I'm not part of that conversation, but it's just interesting that it continues.
Cliff Drysdale on the Wimbledon boycott of 1973. And I guess the thing to note from his account is that people who are at the centre of decisions that prove to be historically pivotal often don't see the historical significance at the time they're in the thick of it. That significance only becomes apparent later. Like with the men, the big battle in women's tennis came a couple of years after the advent of open tennis, but their moment of revolution came in September 1970. Just after Margaret Court completed the first female Open Grand Slam by winning the US Open, a group of nine female players broke away from the tournaments hosted by national associations and signed for a token $1 to play in the first women's professional tournament in Houston, Texas. They became known as the Original Nine and were inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame in 2021 as a group. Anne Jones, the Wimbledon champion in 1969, would have been one of them if she hadn't been pregnant with her first child. But she deserves recognition as one of the first breakaway female professionals. And she told me from her home in the English Midlands just what restrictions the women players were up against as tennis went open.
You have to realise we were so pissed off with the national associations because they told us we could only play 180 days abroad. My association, the British Association, the LTA, you know, you can only travel abroad 180 days. And I wanted to play in Houston or somewhere. And I was already over there for the Caribbean circuit. I didn't want to come back and play in Bournemouth. If you don't come back and play in Bournemouth, it's our national clay court challenges. You won't be selected for the Whiteman Cup. And if you're not selected for the Whiteman Cup, you can't go to the US Open or the American Championships as it was then, because I couldn't afford to pay. So, you know, they ruled us. And you were expected to play in the local against Wales or against Scotland or against Ireland or something, which was fine as long as it fitted into the calendar. But when they wanted you to play straight after Wimbledon on Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday, and when you wanted to go to the Welsh Championships, it didn't work out very well. and they objected when if we said no, when there was retribution. So we were fed up, and I was fed up with mine. And you can imagine with Billie Jean's, she was totally fed up with the USTA because there was Karen, who she played doubles with, Karen Hans. She wasn't. If you weren't in the top four, you didn't get paid anything to play in the American Championships. And this, it was more or less the same in Wimbledon. There were some of us who were given, money to pay to stay in London, as long as you stayed in the Championships. Once you lost, they didn't pay you any more, per diem or something, they called it. And then there were the youngsters, like Christine Truman and myself and Sheila Armstrong. We were called the junior or the young players, something or another, so we got a bit of money out of it. But the rest of the players didn't get anything. And it's fine. It's fine. If you go to a tournament, then they will put you up and they will feed you and you play your tennis. But if you can't do that, you can't. How do you get there? For me, when I started, I had to play in, well, I wanted to play in varying little tournaments around here, like Moseley and Sutton Coldfield and a few other tournaments, and they would pay you £5 or something or another in a voucher form for winning. So then I thought, well, now I need to go to Bristol because Althea Gibson's at Bristol and I need to play some of these better players. So the money that I won went into the train fare to get to Bristol. So, you know...
You were a real amateur.
Yes. Yes, we were. We were total amateurs. And then when it, you know, you're backtracking, really, and I'm going around in circles. But when it came to our fight with the various LTAs, we were fed up with them telling us where we could go, who we could play doubles with. I wanted to play with Renee Schuurman. She's South African. I didn't want to play with some British player. But they ruled us. And we always felt that they didn't have that right, but we didn't have any money to take it to court to fight it. We always thought that they were infringing our civil rights.
Anne Jones, who turned professional a few months before tennis went open, meaning she had a very short period in the tennis wilderness. But even when tennis went open and the players supposedly had control over their own decisions, there were still surprises they hadn't reckoned with. Two of the original nine $1 women professionals, Rosie Casals and Judy Teagart-Dalton, spoke about those early days with Blair Henley. We hear first from the 1968 Wimbledon runner-up Judy Dalton about how each one of the nine had an important role to play.
Each of us had to play a part, and we each did it in the way we felt we wanted to do it, or we felt we should do it. To me, it was like a jigsaw puzzle, you know, putting it all together and then making it a whole. For Kerry, Melvin, Reed and I, it was quite difficult because we got a really hard time in Australia. We weren't allowed to play any tournaments no Australian Open. We weren't allowed to use any Australian equipment. And I was very lucky because I knew Maureen Connolly then. And she said, look, use my... Because she had a racket with Wilson. So I used Wilson rackets and Wilson shoes and everything for nearly 2 years because we weren't allowed to use any Australian equipment or anything.
How were you surviving?
Well, we got appearance money so okay. Under the table.
That was the whole idea of going open because you would get money under the table. So it was amateurism, and that's what... You know, Billie Jean hated that, and I think we disliked that because nobody knew exactly the value. What was he getting? What were you getting? But that is how we survive in the amateur days, is getting, you know, $300 for the week or, you know, $400 and staying privately with housing and that kind of thing. And we didn't want the money under the table. We wanted to earn it just like everybody else, but there wasn't a whole lot.
Well, it was interesting because in Australia they would only let us play 6 months of the year at one stage. Everybody, the men and the women. So what we did, well, it was hard really because, you know, you had to work and then I saved my money. I bought chairs. Because when they had, you know, when they floated companies, in those days there were 5 shilling shares. Which doesn't mean anything to you as Americans.
Pretty cheap.
It's pretty cheap.
Yeah.
And then I just watched when they floated on the stock market, they'd go up a bit, so I'd sell them and put that money aside for the trip. And so that's how we survived. And it was interesting because when I played Billie Jean in the final of Wimbledon, which was the first Open Championship, she got half of what Laver got. So I think Laver got £1,500, Billie got £750, and the runner-up would get half of what the... So, in theory, £375. And our tennis association in Australia wouldn't let me have any of it because they didn't recognise it as open tennis.
Wow.
So I think I had to play in England for something like 4 weeks or 5 weeks for £150. That's what they gave me. So, and Billie didn't know that.
Cheap.
Oh, very cheap. Yes.
You both are so matter of fact. I've now heard you both speak, and there's very much a sense of, well, this was the right thing to do, so this is just what we were going to do. But you realize, though, that there were many people who might have also thought that, but who did not have the courage to move ahead. So what was special about you guys?
Well, we took the risk, and the other people weren't prepared to do it.
I think it's like anything. There are those that when they say they're going to do something, they do it. And I think that, you know, we had been talking to a lot of the women throughout that year and through the summer circuit and everything, when we realized that really money was not being equally distributed, certainly like a 10-to-1 ratio prize money for the women, and they were really being neglected. And, you know, the men were getting priority on courts and finals and times and schedules and what have you. And so finally, when we got to the U.S. Open, we realized that, look, we really need to do something drastic. And so although we had a huge group listening in the locker room there, that little locker room.
None of them were prepared to take the chance.
You know, a few of us made a statement by saying, okay, we're going to stick to this. Gladys Helman came into the picture and talked to us, and we asked her whether she would talk to Jack Kramer. At the time, that was the issue of prize money at the Pacific Southwest, and he was very unwilling to change it. And so we said, well, we're going to go on our own. Gladys said, great. I'll put the tournament together in Houston at the Racquet Club, and we'll get Virginia Slims behind it. And kind of that's how it went. The minute the U.S. Open was done, we flew to Houston. So, you know, here were these nine women, yeah, very committed and knowing that, you know, it was a big risk.
And it was interesting because I did it, Kerry said, well, if Judy knows it's the right thing, I'm prepared to do it. But I can tell you her parents were not at all happy with me. They said, why are you doing it? And Kerry said, no, it's fine, don't worry. And, you know, and then when we had all the rocky bit, I thought, I don't know whether her parents thought, you know, I really have done the wrong thing. But I think in the end they were quite proud of her, actually.
So you had lots of people who were upset with you at one point.
A lot.
Amazing. Yeah. And you stayed the course.
Yep. Yep.
Judy, you told us a story about being thanked in an unusual setting. Can you tell us that story?
Yes, we were playing golf in Scotland at the Renaissance Club, which is now where they play the Scottish Open golf. And there was a girl behind the bar, and she came over and said, was I Judy Dalton? And she said, I just want to thank you for what you've done. She said, I would never have been able to have had a professional scholarship, and she said, I would never have been able to play professional soccer. And she said, you don't realise what influence you all had in doing what you did to other sports, not just tennis, which was just wonderful to hear that. And hopefully they got the photograph, because I sent it to all of them and said, look, this is what you've done. This is just a fantastic effort. That really rang very true, that we don't know what influence we had.
Judy Dalton and earlier Rosie Casals, ending that section on a very upbeat note, emphasising that the pioneering women who launched women's tennis more than 50 years ago delivered a crucial boost to girls and women, not just in tennis, but across the sporting scene and the world in general. The period 1968-73 was a momentous time in tennis. It really did pave the way for the sport to develop into what it is today. We'll have more excerpts from Season 2 of the Tennis Worthy podcast next time, and all 24 interviews from Seasons 1 and 2 are available at tennisfame.com/podcast to listen there and then, or to download so you can enjoy them at your leisure. I'm Chris Bowers. Thanks for listening to the Tennis Worthy podcast. Bye-bye.